everything.
Hello, you're listening to Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, November 8th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Well, it's official. Donald Trump will be the 47th president of the United States. So, now what? For those in and out of the states, the news comes as a bit of a shock. Despite the presidential race being a tight one, particularly over the past few weeks, there were those who held out hope that Kamala Harris and her new way forward was going to win out. But no. Instead, the convicted felon with a history of sexual abuse toward women won. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook joins parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg by phone from France to discuss what Trump's win means for America, Canada, and beyond. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
Carl, can you give me your reaction that we're now looking at a second Donald Trump presidency?
Well, you know, I'm very depressed, very disconsolate, not entirely surprised. Once again, the opinion polls were sort of right, but a little bit seemed to underestimate Trump a bit, as in the past. All the analysts were saying before the election, given how close they were, and many polls were showing a Trump victory, both in the overall popular vote and in the so-called swing states. But other analysts were saying, yes, but maybe this time they're overestimating Trump, but it didn't turn out that way. So it was sort of hoping that those analysts would be right, but not entirely surprised that they were wrong, and that what the polls are showing is, in fact, what was happening. The people seem to be amazingly laser-focused, narrow-focused on two issues there, inflation, or the state of the economy and the state of business and the economy and the state of their perceived economic well-being, and related to that, so-called uncontrolled immigration. And they echo issues that are becoming very important in Canada, too. They're sort of the same issues in Canada. They take a different form in Canada. We're a different kind of society. We have a different kind of politics. But those issues are very big in Canada also. Immigration doesn't take quite the same harsh aspect as it does in the States and Canada. And all of Donald Trump's frightful personal qualities, and not only that, his tendency to authoritarianism and his totally unprecedented ability to completely break all the rules of any kind of respectful discourse and just go around lying and calling people names and insulting people. All of this didn't seem to matter to people. It's totally discounted in his case. In fact, coverage of the campaign was very hard on Kamala Harris for some inconsistency, for the usual political thing. Well, you've been inconsistent, you change your positions. You're not giving clear answers, you're giving canned rhetoric, all of which was true, and yet Michelle Obama complained at one point. But we seem to be measuring Kamala Harris by normal standards, and then we have a completely different, standard after which you measure Trump.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely a shock, but it's very, very depressing.
You know, you mentioned all the things that Trump is able to get away with. It wasn't just, saying some crude things. He is a convicted felon. He's been adjudicated to be liable for sexual assault. He had many cases pending with, serious national security implications in terms of documents that he was keeping at his residence in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. And all that didn't seem to matter. Does that seem to speak to you that, we're going down a road where more people in North America and Europe are finding fascism palpable, and that they were okay with, the threats of tariffs, mass deportations, and having someone at the head of government who is, so openly bigoted, both towards people of other cultures and women?
I think, sadly, I'm in France now visiting family who live here. So I can say that, you know, France had this experience last spring when Emmanuel Macron, as a result of European elections where his party did very badly, and other allies of his and other sort of mainstream parties, and the Assemblement National, the far-right fascistic party that used to be called the Front National, and that was founded by Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was put this together with a group of characters who came out of the Algerian struggle for independence, and they were on the other side of the pro-independence side, and taken over by his daughter, who made it more respectable. They did very well, and they did very well in the first round of the legislative elections. But there's a man who we ran into, didn't talk to him, but we ran into him at a museum in Paris called the Musée Carnavala, historical museum. There he was with all kinds of people surrounding him. And his name is Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and he's the leader of a party called La France Insoumise, which is left-wing party that moved away from the traditional socialist party, which was not that different from, in a way, from our liberal party or from the American Democratic Party. François Hollande was the last president of the Socialist Party. Previous to that, Mitterrand, of course, was their longest-serving president. And Mélenchon was looking at this American election in a commentary. We didn't ask him about it, but we saw a commentary of his, and he was making some interesting comments. He said some of the things that happened to French people in the American election are going to be very surprising. One thing, there's unlimited money. In France, €7,500, which is, I think, about $10,000, is the most anybody can give. And I think in Canada it's less, actually. I've forgotten the number in Canada. And corporations and associations and unions can't contribute money at all, period, which is the same in Canada. Then he said, and the American campaign is entirely about, his point, Mélenchon, was that, in fact, there is a huge ideological overlap between the Democrats and the Republicans, despite their claims to be standing for opposite values and ideologies. I think he may have overstated that point. I think that was more a point of the past. But nonetheless, he said that. He said, because of that, the campaign is reduced to personal invective and insults and negative advertising. He says, well, French people won't know what negative advertising is. It's illegal in France. You're not allowed to advertise negatively about other parties, period. Totally illegal. So, like, almost the entirety of American political advertising would be against the law in France. So an interesting point. And another small interesting point that Canadians are thinking about, seeing this from France. Here in the United States, it were just the two parties, so there was no strategy that one could have used to get people not to waste their votes on third parties. And nobody is saying that third-party votes would have been enough to get Kamala Harris over the top. But in Canada, there are some people are contacting me, putting together a movement, signing a petition and trying to encourage the Liberals, Greens, and New Democrats to do what Jean-Luc Mélenchon and the leader of the French Green Party and the leader of the Socialist Party and the leader of other smaller left-wing parties did during the second round of the French parliamentary elections. And I won't go into an explanation of how their elections work, but suffice to say that if you don't get over 50%, you're not elected.
Right.
You've done the first round. So they have a second round. And they just founded essentially a new party, the Nouveau Front Populaire, the New Popular Front, which echoed the first major left-wing government in the history of France, in many ways,
right,
or in the modern history, of the 1930s, the Popular Front, led by Léon Blum. And you'll see streets all over France named after Léon Blum, by the way. So they did it, and they succeeded in coming first in the end. So in Canada, I doubt that we'll see people doing that, even seeing the election of Trump won't give our political parties their come-to-Jesus moment, and I don't think that's going to happen.
You know, just with the effect on the Canadian political scene, we have a politician in Pierre Poilievre who echoes some of the, you know, main talking points of Donald Trump. Poilievre this morning has already issued his heartfelt congratulations to Trump. Do you feel that a Trump victory buoys up Poilievre's chances of winning in a federal election? Or maybe do you think it'll be a little bit like consuming too much alcohol or too much candy? Like, people will see Trump and he just soaks up all of that energy and they run away from politicians in Canada who represent Trump's style politics.
Well, I mean, I think I have read other commentators who said the best thing for Trudeau would be if Trump were to win, and then Canadians would react to provide a counterbalance to Trump, and Poilievre wouldn't be that. I've had other people writing me privately saying, well, do you think there's a massive plot that Poilievre is in cahoots with Trump to fold up tents in Canada and to allow the United States to annex Canada? That would be the plot. I think it's a bit far-fetched myself. I think that Poilievre is more of a bit of a Canadian nationalist. Anyway, I mean, his advertising is all about the Canadian flag. I think that would be a little awkward for him to pull them to tend to say, let's be annexed by the United States. And I don't think that would be too popular. I don't think that would likely happen. But I'm not convinced that it really has a major impact. Certainly, the politicians can't be open about it. Maybe the NDP could be a little bit if they don't think that they're going to be in a situation where they're going to have to deal with Trump at some point. So, but I don't think Justin Trudeau is going to want to go around dissing Trump and saying, Canadians, vote for me because I'll stand up to this tyrant and this dangerous fascist Trump, and don't vote for Poilievre because he admires him and because he's just like him. I think you can't really get it. So it's going to be more in terms of the vapors and the mood and atmosphere and how people feel about things, but it won't be an overt part of any kind of election campaign, and it really can't be. If you think you're going to have to deal with the guy the day after the election, you're not going to want to be campaigning on the basis that you're going to be taking him on and that he is evil incarnate. So I'm not sure there's a huge impact that way. I think what the impact is more to allow us to reflect on the huge impact on politics that the sense of weightlessness, economic weightlessness, of lack of solid foundation in our economic prospects, the huge backlash type of response that it generates and that has generated historically. I mean, when governments cannot seem to find a way to control rapidly rising costs of everything, people start to lose faith in the fundamentals of our political, our economic system. And sometimes, I guess, if we had some kind of better organized and better rooted and better argued socialist alternative, they might turn to that. But populist right-wing ideology and fascism is historically, going back to the early 20th century, a great tool for getting people who might otherwise be attracted by left-wing options. And you see in the States, the business community, many elements of the business community and traditional Republicans all lining up behind Trump because he essentially protects their interests and keeps the world safe for them while having this capacity to attract the little people at the same time who feel the world doesn't work for them.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the economy because, one of Trump's main campaign points, bizarrely, is to put a significant tariff on all goods imported into the United States, which sounds like something out of the 19th century to me. But Canada is the U.S.'s largest trading partner. How do you think, if he does follow through with that tariff plan, how that will affect the Canadian economy?
I think I don't think he could actually do it for Canada because we have a trade agreement with him. So what he'll try to do is renegotiate that trade agreement. He did renegotiate what they called NAFTA, but now they call the USMCA agreement. And I think he's going to go back to the well with that. And I think the danger for Canada is they'll start putting, ironically, just as Trump is being elected, the new provisions in the newly renegotiated free trade agreement with Canada are allowing much more access to the Canadian market of dairy products. And people in the agriculture business, food business, and food activists are warning Canadian consumers, look out for these American brands on your shelves because they don't regulate dairy the same way we do, and you're going to have GMO and all kinds of stuff in your milk and cheese and butter that you don't get in Canada, and you want to watch out for that. So that's just happening now, but there's much more that Trump could start pushing for. But I think that people like Trump are going to start realizing they don't like having Canada as even a moderate, only slightly different model of society just north of the border from what they have. I mean, and the great some of the great symbols or tokens of the of our difference as a society, which Canadians may not always realize, are, of course, our universal healthcare model, completely different from what the Americans have, notwithstanding Obamacare, and two, such provisions as parental leave, which the Americans don't have. As somebody who studies these things pointed out to me the other day, the Americans are down with Papua New Guinea as the worst parental leave in the world. They have none, you know, and we have quite an elaborate system of parental leave, and we have the child tax benefit, and we have the health system.
So, you know, something else that we also have that we share with the U.S. is the longest land border in the world.
Yes, we do have the longest land border in the world, and that's the immigration issue will play out there. But just to finish on the economic issue for just for a brief second, they could look in trade negotiations at issues like our healthcare system and how that is, provides an unfair, non-monetary, competitive advantage. It's a kind of incentive to investors or an incentive to employers. But if you invest in Canada or employ people in Canada, you're not going to have to worry about providing health benefits to your workers because that's already taken care of. And they can say, well, that's an unfair, so you're going to have to pay a price for that. We're going to have to impose some kind of measure on your product because you have this unfair advantage. But the border is a huge, the biggest and one of the most biggest and frightful things that Trump is promising to do is start running around and institute a reign of terror on immigrants.
And remember, the Supreme Court has said that he cannot be held criminally responsible for anything he does as an official act as president. So this gives him a whole new range of actions he can take against immigrants, against political enemies. And do you think that would really destabilize the United States politically, militarily? And what sort of consequences would that be for Canada with us sharing this large border?
I mean, just talking about immigrants, he's talking about taking everybody who is so-called is a non-regular or non-conventional migrant, you know, including all kinds of refugee claimants, taking all the people who are supposedly they claim to be illegal aliens and just, you know, kicking them out in one fell swoop. And, I mean, the economy would die because these people are all working. It would be have a huge, terrible economic impact, but also it might impel many of these people to try to come to Canada. And right now, Canada, we're at a stage where we think, you know, our lifeboat Canada suddenly is a little fuller than we want it to be, and that we're trying to cut back on temporary workers and on foreign students and on other categories of migrants in Canada because we discovered that we haven't got enough housing for everybody here. So there is a, you know, a move afloat. But, well, you know, Minister Miller has announced a number of moves to restrict migration into Canada. And, you know, we have been known as one of the most small-L liberal countries with respect to migration. And generally, the Conservatives have not been opposed to that. They've not really, but they've tried to demonize certain categories of migrants, certainly people in the refugee class who had come by boat, you know, just arrived by boat. They didn't want those people. People such as the Roma people of Central and Eastern Europe, who would come here as tourists without a visa, you know, just coming in because they could come in from the countries they live in that way, and then claiming asylum. They said these people were economic migrants who were abusing the asylum system. But overall, we have been seeking, as certainly with the Trudeau government, to increase our population quickly and to bring in as many as a million people, new people, over 2 years or something like that.
Yeah, and, you know, just speaking on the immigrant issue, because, you know, the U.S. election obviously will affect a lot of things around the world. And you know, there are potential for the creation of, a lot more migrants escaping conflict in the coming years under a Trump-led United States. You know, I'm talking about Ukraine, which is being invaded by a dictator from Russia. We're seeing violence in the Middle East as Israel attacks Gaza and the Palestinians and now Lebanon. You know, we also have what the future of NATO might be. So just wonder if you could talk for a little bit on those issues, too.
So I think the interesting thing is here, what seems to be to be Trump's point of view is he will sign on 100% Netanyahu. And I think Netanyahu wanted Trump to be there long term. Netanyahu has an ugly and horrible plan to essentially completely annexed both the West Bank and now Gaza, you know, these territories, and now a piece of Lebanon, and create a greater, a little Israeli empire there. And defenders of Israel often say, well, you know, there's a million Israeli Arabs, mostly Muslims, living full citizenship in Israel. They're completely part of Israel. They have all the rights there. They leave out the fact that they're not permitted to serve in the military, which is not necessarily a privilege, because the military is the key institution in Israeli society, and they're banned from taking part in the military still. But they don't mention the fact that, yes, but there are 750,000 Israeli Jews living in the West Bank who vote in Israel, who travel back and forth freely to Israel, who are part of the Israeli economy, who are full Israeli citizens, while the rest of the people in the same territory that where they live are citizens of some subservient area called essentially an occupied territory with a kind of partially autonomous local government, and who have none of the same rights. Now, if that's not, I was in South Africa during apartheid. That's how the apartheid system worked. So Israel has, within the pre-67 borders of Israel, does have a universal system where there's a universal citizenship, and they don't really have anything resembling apartheid for any group within the society. But they operate an apartheid system on the West Bank. I mean, on Gaza, they were up until the current troubles, until the current violence. They were essentially treating it as an area to be sealed off and controlled and limited. And I don't know what they really hoped those people would do. But I think they thought they could keep them tame and they could actually cultivate Hamas in a funny way. The group that they always feared was the Palestinian Authority, what they used to call Fatah, which was willing to negotiate with Israel, which had something like a recognizable government. And Israel's view was, well, you know, Hamas are sufficiently nutty and disorganized and fanatical that we'll just keep giving them money and they'll keep ranting and raving. And they never expected they'd actually act on anything that they talked about. So now their reaction is so out of proportion that it's become a new process on itself. So this, you know, the horrible events of October 7th and the terrible and utterly lacking in morality and utterly brutal murder of the 1,200 people in Israel by the Hamas fighters at that time became a sort of pretext for Israel then not to deal with this as a police measure and as a measure to find the response of people and deal with that, but as an opportunity to engage in something that looks a lot like ethnic cleansing.
And
married to genocide. So
and now Donald Trump is prepared to fund and supply that.
He'll accept that. Kamala Harris, unfortunately for Kamala Harris, politically, she got it both ways. Many, many Jewish voters believed Trump when he said she hates Israel. Many, many Jews in the diaspora, in the United States and outside, and in Israel, believed Kamala Harris was hostile to Israel. Yet the large Arab and Muslim population in certain areas of the country essentially held her accountable for Joe Biden's rather hypocritical policy of verbally criticizing Israel and then sending them arms and money all the time, never saying, okay, Israel, if you're going to be continuing to pursue this action in a way that we consider to be totally disproportionate and wrong and counterproductive, we're going to stop helping you because they have all the power to. Israel's completely dependent on American help. So Kamala Harris paid the price for that. She never could say what many suspect she really believed, which is, when I'm there, I will use leverage against Netanyahu. Certainly, Trump holds it all. Trump claims, he said to Netanyahu, look, you better wrap this war up fast because you're losing support all over the world. So Trump is enough of a kind of a person who looks at television ratings and looks at popularity indexes to see, well, nobody seems to like this. There's nobody in the world who's really on your side here, except us, sort of.
Yeah, well, I think definitely, you know, we're going to see history unfold before us and look back to this week's election. And I think it will be one of the great what-ifs of history. But Carl, thanks so much for joining us today and giving us your insights.
Thank you. Take care.
That was Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg in conversation with Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Thanks so much for that discussion, Carl and Nick. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Nick, back to you.
Thanks, Brianne. In national news this week, the nation is mourning and remembering the life of Murray St. Clair. The Indigenous lawyer, judge, and senator is perhaps best remembered for leading the Truth and Reconciliation Commission from 2009 to 2015. The commission was charged with examining the legacy and impacts of Canada's Indian residential school system. The commission issued 94 calls to action to help find justice and reach reconciliation. Sinclair's family issued a statement on Monday, November 4th, announcing his passing. He was 73 years old. In labor news, columnist Tom Sanborn looks at the ongoing negotiations between Boeing and its employees, workers who are represented by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers in Oregon and Washington in the U.S. At issue are pensions. Pension entitlements for workers were lost in contract negotiations almost a decade ago, and the union feels that now is the time to get them back. Last week, nearly 200 workers and their supporters from around the world met virtually to show support for the striking workers. Meanwhile, moneyed interests are concerned about how this current work disruption will affect Boeing's supply chain and profit margin. Republican governors in the U.S. have written to the union urging them to settle with their employer. And finally, how just is Canada's justice system? This is the question we pose on this month's Off the Hill political panel. Join us on Wednesday, November 20th, 2024, as we dive into this discussion with poet and activist Elle Jones, policy analyst Chuka Ejekam, and Rabble's own parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg. Panel starts at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Register today with a link on rabble.ca to join us for this free panel. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.